Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio 6 near the baobab tree at Musasani Beach in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. In tonight's episode, our 39th, we converse with Dr. Sarah Smiley from Ohio and look at the various geographies of Dar es Salaam. Stay tuned. Dr. Smiley is an urban geographer with research interests in both water and development. She uses qualitative methods, including surveys, interviews, participant observation, video, mental mapping, and archival research. She's also a walker, a city walker. She's been interested in the ways that the colonial legacies of segregation and housing and amenity provision affect everyday life in sub-Saharan Africa, specifically in Tanzania and in Dar es Salaam. Her current research analyzes what access to water really means for those people living in the different districts in Dar es Salaam. She's looking at how the price, availability, reliability, and quality of water, along with the physical act of walking to collect it, impact water access. She joins us in Studio 6 to discuss the legacy of historical segregation on the urban landscape of Dar es Salaam, to look at how advances in urban infrastructure, specifically transportation infrastructure, are trying to keep up with the rapid growth of this sub-Saharan African city. And we look at water and access to it. First, I'd like to know how she got to know Dar es Salaam.
I did my master's and PhD coursework in geography at the University of Kansas. And while I was at Kansas, I studied Kiswahili, the major language of East Africa and the official language of Tanzania. And I came to Tanzania in 2004, the summer of 2004, for a Swahili language program. And we came to Dar for about 3 days. And it was my first time in the city, and it was an amazing experience to be able to walk around the streets of this bustling town. And I came back to Kansas after that language program and was coming up with my PhD dissertation topic and decided I wanted to look at how Dar es Salaam is represented in media. So I was interested in how it was represented in comics and music and newspapers, all kinds of different parts of media. And I had this great dissertation planned. I came here, started collecting the data, I was meeting with cartoonists, I met with the owner of Clouds FM and was collecting all kinds of information. But then my topic changed. I was living in what is predominantly the Indian part of the city, the Asian part of the city, and all of my American friends thought it was weird that I was a white American. I was not supposed to live in the Indian area. I was supposed to live on the Musasani Peninsula with all the other foreigners. My Tanzanian friends also thought I was very weird. My Indian friends thought I was weird. And I realized that I was out of place, that I was living someplace that I wasn't supposed to live. So I started looking into that. I went to the National Archives and started reading about the history of the city, how it was planned and how it was segregated, and I totally changed my research focus and started looking at the history of the city and the legacies of colonialism.
So it's interesting to go from maybe looking at these outside representations or mm-hmm. how Tanzania is represented to the outside world mm-hmm. to then being here on the ground and then looking sort of inside Dar for how the urban landscape is in many ways segregated. Is that a shift from, does that happen because you get to know the city more? Is that part of that? That initial question is, I'm curious how and why I know what I know about Dar. Where does it come from? What popular sort of representations are formulating the way I think about it, to then you're kind of used to being here and then you want to look at something closer at hand? Is that part of what happened? Or?
A lot of it was just the everyday experiences. So yeah. I shopped at Indian markets because those were the closest to where I lived in the city center. And there weren't a lot of white faces walking around. I was one of the few Mzungu who lived in city center at all. And so I saw these very different spaces and realized that they were, that the feeling of them, the climate of them, I guess, was very, very unique to each one. That the Asian area was loud and colorful and people walking around, women in gorgeous clothes. You had temples, you had mosques, you had churches. And so someone always was worshiping. There was always music, there was always noise, people selling things. The peninsula where the foreigners live is very quiet. People drive everywhere. You don't have a lot of roadside vendors. African areas, equally loud and colorful and smells and sounds, but a different feeling than the Asian area. They different spice smells. Obviously the people look different, the different types of goods being sold, different people running the shops. But yeah, it was very much an experience of just walking around and seeing the differences.
So it's a scale kind of issue or question too. Like you get to see more of the local scale and see those differences of moving or navigating across the city from one space to another. And is that something that, it sounds like it drew you to this question? I mean, part of the question though too is the historical legacy, and knowing your work and what this project turned into being, having read some of the work, was that what you wanted to initially look at? Was, well, why is this? Why do we have these distinct regions? And are they historically produced? And are they the legacy of something from the past?
Well, for the scale bit, the funny thing is there are very clear lines. When you look at the city, you can see where these different areas end. That the main one, as you're moving toward the peninsula where the foreigners tend to live, you cross a bridge. You might not notice it's a bridge, it's not very elevated, but it's the Silander Bridge, and that's the mark of leaving the city and going toward the peninsula. So it's a very clear distinction. Going from the Asian area to the African area, there's a big open space that today is there's a monument for independence, it's a park, but it's a very clear dividing line between these areas. So you do see these divisions. They're not quite walls or barriers, but they're there if you look for them. But for the second part, once I realized there was this history of segregation, and I was reading about it in the archives and seeing how it all developed, my curiosity was, what does that mean for today? So why did that history mean that people told me I was living in the wrong space? That what was lingering, what parts of colonialism lingered today? So what I ended up doing was going around the city and talking to people and asking them where they bought their food, where they bought their fruits and vegetables, their meat, where they went for fun, whether it was for dancing or music or beach or drinks, where they bought their clothes, where they did these everyday activities.
These routines, so to speak.
Yeah, these routine things that everyone does but doesn't think so much about them. That they're not conscious choices all the time. You just go to the place you go to. And then mapped those out and compared the historical segregated spaces to where people said that they still went today. And they matched up pretty much entirely. It was a very clear legacy that even though people can shop anywhere, they can go anywhere, these divisions still linger today.
So, for instance, the Masasani Peninsula or the Masaki area, mm-hmm. I think I hear both names being used, used to be sort of the European colonial district. It has larger plot sizes. If we look at a satellite image, it has more trees. It has more space. The housing density is lower, and so provides for a different kind of living. The people that lived here before were European and spent their time out here, and the people that live here today continue to be that, right? That hasn't changed, has it?
Yeah, and the history that created those bigger plots and bigger houses is an interesting history, because Dar es Salaam was German first, or Tanzania was German first, and then British after World War I. And the segregation started under the Germans and really took off under the British. The Germans didn't rule long enough to really establish the segregation. But the British were very careful to say that they did not segregate by race. There's actually an entire file in the National Archives called Segregation of Races. But the theme of it is that we don't segregate by races, that trying to say that that's not what was happening. So instead, the governments created building ordinances that said Zone 1 was the European zone. But it wasn't technically the European zone. It was the zone that had buildings of a European type. So they had to have a certain size. They had to have a toilet connected to a sewer system. They had to have a real roof and sturdy building materials. Zone 2 was the Asian commercial area. Zone 3 was the African area. So the African area could have thatched roofs. It didn't have to be sturdy materials where the European area did. So the governments would say, well, it's not racial segregation. A European could live in a thatched roof house. An African could live in a house with a flush toilet. But in practice, they knew that a flush toilet requires a certain amount of money. A house that big requires money. And so it came to that same desired result, even though there was not officially segregation of races.
Like in South Africa or...
Yeah, so the different South Africa...
American history as well.
Yeah, where it was very formal under apartheid. Much of the rest of the African continent was very segregated, but much more subtly.
Yeah.
So sometimes it was for health reasons, that separating Africans from Europeans to prevent Europeans from catching malaria, not to prevent Africans from catching a European disease.
Right.
Sometimes it was about fire risk, that thatched roof houses might catch fire, so we want to separate them.
Yeah.
So it was all very subtle segregation. But it was very much racial segregation. And they certainly knew that. There's comments all through the archives that talk about the European area.
Yeah.
And so in practice, that's what it was, even though it technically wasn't only for Europeans. So there are reasons why, when you look down from above at those plots, that the houses are that size, because that's how the area was planned to be in order to have the desired population there.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Walk us through. You first came here how many years ago?
My first trip to Tanzania was 2004.
2004.
When I did a Swahili study.
Yeah.
Then my dissertation research was 2005 to 2006. So I was here for about 11 months, all doing research in Dar es Salaam the whole time.
Yeah. And now, over 10 years since that research, you would assume that these mental maps, these routine spaces, are still pretty much the same. Or some changing?
I think there's some changing. Kariakou is still always going to be the historic African market where that's the hub of African life.
Yeah.
But the city has grown so much. When I first came here, the city had about 2 million people.
Uh-huh.
And now they're estimating 5 or 5.5 million.
So even in the time, so 2004 to, let's just round up and say 14 years, it's
more than doubled.
More than doubled. So the doubling time, which is a concept we talk about in urban geography,
yeah,
and or in population studies, demography stuff, the doubling time for Dar currently is more than double at this point with 14 mm-hmm. years. It's probably like 11 years is the doubling time of the population of Dar?
About, yeah.
Wow.
It's growing, they estimate, about 5.5% right now, but there were times Dar es Salaam was growing at 10%. It's been one of the fastest growing cities on the continent. So as that growth has happened, you have people who are living further outside of the city.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily practical to come into Kariakou, which is a very central part of the city, for the market when there's another market closer. So there's some competition for those spaces. But if we walk around the peninsula today, it's still going to look largely the way it did when I first came.
Yeah.
If we walk around Kisutu, the Indian Quarter, it'll still look largely the same. The differences are that it's today, it's not just racial segregation, it's economic, it's class segregation.
Yeah.
So as you do see more African faces in other parts of the city that maybe were economically unavailable in the past. But I wouldn't say that the opposite is true, that if we went out to Hugu, a very far part of the city, or Kimara,
past the airport,
these,
the hills, the hiking area,
we're not going to see a large number of European or white faces there. So it's not a total flip in that sense.
Right.
But with the growth, the city's huge now. It's physically larger, it's obviously larger in terms of population, so that's changing some of the patterns. Traffic is, of course, a horrible concern that it takes.
And have you seen that change? Because that must be a chief indicator of the growth, right?
Traffic has always been bad, because most of the main roads were planned during the colonial era, when the city was less than 1 million people, when it was less than 100,000. In early colonial times.
Right, so, yeah, that's always fascinates me, this idea that the year 1900, the population of Dar was in the thousands, right?
Yeah, I think it was about 3,000 or 4,000 at the time. It was definitely under 10.
Yeah.
And
it was a fishing village. Well, a large fishing village, but a village, essentially.
And then it slowly started creeping up, getting into the hundreds of thousands, and now 5.5 million. But the main roads, when you look at the city, the kind of
arterial
yeah. roads, some of them are still two-lane roads. They've expanded some of them, but they weren't designed to carry this much traffic.
Yeah.
It's just not space. They're expanding some. They're trying to widen some roads to help, but that's also part of the changing socioeconomic structure, that more people now have cars.
And that is the issue, right? As the city grows, we also think of its growth economically too, right?
Yeah.
And that's what's bringing more people, is because there are some economic opportunities.
Yeah.
It's being connected more. You know, I was down at the port again just yesterday, and you see these huge barges coming in and out. I mean, just showing the connection that Dar has to the world economy. And so you have the growth of a middle class, which people hint towards or talk about in East Africa in general. And once you do have that extra money, you can buy a car. And that's, there's just too many cars on the road. Is that everywhere?
I think that's everywhere. But if we were to go to Cleveland, someplace close, or Cincinnati, a place close to where we've both spent time, the main roads are going to be 4 lanes in each direction, 5 lanes maybe, depending on what highway you're at. And here, they might be 4 with the local buses making a couple extra lanes on the side that aren't official.
Yeah. So the infrastructure, mm-hmm. and this is going to get us to where we're eventually going in our conversation, but the infrastructure can't keep up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And electricity has always been a huge problem and still is a huge problem today, literally today, as we sit with no power.
Yeah.
And part of the traffic legacy was that there are very few stoplights or traffic lights. And when there were traffic lights, they didn't necessarily have electricity, so they weren't functioning. So you would have these gridlock intersections of cars going in every direction to where they would get interlocking puzzle pieces. And no one wanted to be the car that backed up to give any room.
Right.
Because then they're not going to get to go next. So it would just be a mess, and occasionally someone would just come out, a bus driver would come and try to direct cars.
Yeah.
So you started having traffic police who would come and try to direct some of the flow, which was very helpful when there was no traffic lights.
Yeah.
But now that the lights are functioning, you still have some of those attempts to move traffic through, and sometimes that causes more backups because they're not necessarily coordinated with each other.
Right. I mean, even just going to work in the morning, there are lights, but there are traffic police mm-hmm. that essentially say the light doesn't...
Yeah.
The light, don't pay attention to the light, pay attention to us. And if they're not coordinated downstream, so mm-hmm. to speak, then there's major, major backups.
And you sometimes see that they're coordinated. You'll see them on a walkie-talkie
or
on their phone, but often they're not. And they're focused very much on one direction, so that the other direction gets backed up. So that's part of the infrastructure problem. Too narrow of roads, not coordinated traffic movement. And that's a problem. Lots of cities struggle
with
sure.
this. These are urban design, urban planning questions that are universal.
Yeah, the town I grew up in, our main road through town, they change the number of lanes in each direction depending on the time of day. So in the morning, more lanes go into downtown, in the afternoon, more go out. But inevitably, you get stuck at every light because they're not coordinated.
Yeah.
So it happens everywhere. But here, you tend to sit longer when you sit here, that you can sit for an hour at an intersection and not move.
Yeah. The BRT, the rapid transit, mm-hmm. that seems like a good solution. I finally did ride on it yesterday. You'll be impressed, maybe, from city center out mm-hmm. here to mm-hmm. Morocco.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and it's very fast. And
When I was here for my dissertation research in 2005, it was the headline. I'll have to dig it out of my files when I go back to the U.S., that the BRT was being planned in 2005, that it was being talked about. This is what Dar es Salaam needs to move traffic.
What does the B stand for? Is it?
Bus Rapid Transit.
Bus Rapid Transit.
Yeah. All right.
I've also seen DART. Dar Rapid Transit, is that?
Yeah,
I like that.
I think
better.
That's the official name, but BRT.
That's the one that's
I
stuck.
I think is the thing that's stuck.
Yeah, DART sounds good though.
Yeah, DART sounds very official.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've been planning it for ages. When I was here last in 2014, it was under construction, so they were widening roads and places to get the dedicated bus lanes in. Which meant a lot of things were torn down because they were too close to the roads.
Displacement of people mm-hmm. included, yeah.
And in some cases, it meant that there were some infrastructure improvements, that they put in some pipes while they were doing this. In other places, it actually made problems worse because it destroyed pipes that then weren't fixed, so it wasn't always an improvement in that sense.
Yeah.
But they were building everything, but they hadn't even bought the buses in 2014. So they were building the platforms without knowing what buses they were going to be buying.
Yeah.
And were they designing them correctly? And it just opened last year, I believe. It's been, I don't even know if it's been up and running for a year now.
Oh, so it's really new.
It's really new.
All right.
And they're have phase one finish, and there's going to be six phases.
Of the lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So eventually it'll go to the university. It'll go a little bit onto the peninsula, supposedly out to the airport.
Ah, wow.
So there's going to be lots of extensions from it.
So that building that's happening out on the main road, Nereri Road, out mm-hmm. to the airport, that sort of ramp that you see at some point?
They're doing like the flyovers.
Yeah, is that for cars and the bus or just the...
So that intersection, the flyover that's under construction is the Tazara intersection. It's near the Tazara train station.
Oh, it's near the train station.
And that is historically has always been the worst
congested
intersection in the city, it seems
like. Yeah.
For no real reason. Like, you could never really figure it out, but it was always stuck. So that's supposed to alleviate some of the mess at that intersection. But the construction is causing problems because it's narrowing the roads a little bit.
Yeah.
So there will be a BRT lane
going out
in there
way.
At some point. But this is just part of trying
more
to...
More of a general...
More general improvements. That they've started building more of these flyovers. The one at Morocco was fairly new with the BRT. There's a few throughout the city. So it is great. It's more expensive than the regular Dalla Dallas.
But not much.
It's
$650 versus $400, right?
But for someone who's making...
Of course, that's a lot.
Bringing home 1,000 shillings a day.
That's significant, yeah.
But there was a big conversation of what the fare should be. And it was talked about to have it be significantly more than what it settled at. So I think, me personally, I wonder if it will raise once
eventually,
it's been around a little bit longer. But
so for some people, it's not ever
going
to be an improvement.
For some people, it's not.
They'll never be able to enjoy that improvement.
And it right now, if it's not going, if you don't live
if
right
you don't
on
live
the line.
Near, right, right.
And it's still very crowded. So if you don't get on at the first stop, sometimes it's very difficult to cram on to the buses.
Yeah.
But when you can get on at a time that's not so crowded, or you can just fly by all the traffic, it is pretty nice.
Pretty nice, because it's the difference between maybe, what, a 10,000 shilling bajaji ride, 15,000 taxi ride?
Yeah, from...
From that same Morocco area to
Morocco
the city center?
Morocco to city center during the day is about 10,000 shillings.
Yeah, and you could pay
$650. Dalla Dalla would be $400 or $650 on the BRT. And you can't even take a Bajaj. Bajaj can't go across Sealander Bridge.
All right.
So you can only take a real taxi. Or you'd have to change Bajaj once you get to the bridge to ones that are allowed to drive in the city.
Huh. Oh, because there's some zones, right?
Yeah, and so even motorcycles, only certain ones. Certain ones are allowed in the city.
Yeah.
But so yeah, the BRT was a long time in plans, and it is moving a lot of. It's definitely moving a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'll be curious how the airport one goes. What that will mean. In terms of moving people, because that's a very congested road. But then are you going to have people coming on with huge suitcases to an already crowded bus?
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, Radio Expeditions, into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring together academic and everyday geographical or spatial thinking. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions. How does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
So your friends thought you were weird. The people in your neighborhood thought you were weird. You're probably one of a few people from abroad, just to kind of generally describe you, who know the city actually very, very well. Because most people do, like you said, come here, and even if they've lived here for 5 years working for their embassy or working for some NGO, they do fall into these routine spaces and don't really see beyond those.
Yeah.
But you've definitely challenged that. And your current project, which is an extension now, I think, of our discussion of infrastructure, is looking at how people access water in all of the different neighborhoods of Dar es Salaam, including, I think, ones that, I mean, I've only been here a short time, but I've certainly never heard of. And I think a lot of people that even have lived here for quite a while might not know by name. They might know, generally speaking, if you were to give them direction, but might not know by name. What is the rest of Dar es Salaam? What's it like?
In terms of knowing the city, I'll say that the way I've learned it is through buses, through daladalas,
Riding
around to reach different places. The BRT is amazing, but it only goes
a few places.
And it wasn't around when I first came. Bajaj weren't here the first time I came. So you had just regular taxis, but
all
some
right.
of the places we go are not road accessible once you get off the main road. So it's been a lot of buses and then walking through neighborhoods. So it's been a lot of miles and hours to learn the city. But as you start moving away from the city center, from Kisutu, the Indian Quarter, that's technically part of city center, and the peninsula, things definitely change. And it goes back to some of that historical context we were talking about earlier, that part of the segregation of races that wasn't really segregation of races had different standards for services, for amenities. So European homes in the Zone 1 had direct piped connections. African homes, entire neighborhoods would share one standpipe. So a pipe with a faucet on it that would be in a public space where you would walk and fetch your water. So it was a very different situation. Europeans had water in their house.
Yeah.
Africans shared very few. In the case of thousands of houses potentially sharing one pipe or two pipes. So we're not talking about a pipe for five houses or something. These were large numbers of people sharing a few numbers of pipes. And so learning that history made me curious about those legacies of social services, of amenities. So I started exploring out a little bit to see what's happened. Have things changed? Because much of the infrastructure, just like the roads, goes back to the colonial times.
Yeah.
The piped water network dates to the German colonial era. The Germans came in 1885, officially began in 85, then left after the end of the First World War. So they put in the bones of the first piped system. It was all using groundwater, so it wasn't the same as today. But they started it. The British continued. there's three treatment plants that are doing intakes from rivers. Two of them are British. One was from, one definitely in the 50s, the other the 40s or the 50s. The third is from the mid 70s. So this is old infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so the fact that these pipes were laid during the colonial era and there hasn't been a lot of improvement to them means areas that didn't have direct pipes to their houses in the past largely still lack those pipes today. And so it's very much a lingering aspect of the colonial history and the segregation history.
Because the colonials, the Germans and mm-hmm. British, would have developed their water infrastructure yeah. first, of course.
Yeah. yeah. So when you start moving, when I first started doing the water research, so I first started looking at water in 2011, and I saw a lot of those public standpipes where you would go and you would see just in the middle of a street, just kind of in a little public square almost, a pipe about maybe 2.5 feet tall from yeah. the ground with a faucet. I always, when I try to describe it to someone, I say like the faucet I have on the side of my house that I put my hose, that I connect my hose to. So
yeah.
yeah, I always say the thing you spin, the spigot.
Yeah.
That it, a pipe like that, where you could, you would spin it, turn the water, then close the pipe. Sometimes a concrete block to put your bucket on.
Uh-huh.
And then that would be your public water fetching point. And so you, in 2011, you saw a lot of these. You saw women, water fetching is predominantly done by women. Women walking with their buckets, fetching
what
water.
What age, like moms or the oldest daughter? The
so it's about 75% is done by women, girls, and boys.
Yeah.
So girls and boys would be definitely under 18, maybe even under 16.
Uh-huh.
So men do very little of the water burden and very little of the domestic activities. When you find men doing it, it's largely because they're bachelors or sometimes they're being, they're an employee who's fetching water for someone else or they're a son with their parents. You don't so much find a family where the husband of the family or the father is the one in charge of water collection. It's going to be the mom or the young kids. Sometimes little children. I've seen definitely elementary school aged girls and boys catching water.
Carrying how much?
Traditionally, it was always 20 liter buckets. Whoa. So 5 gallons.
Which is 35 pounds?
It's 40, is it 7 pounds? It's 44 kilograms roughly, so about 20 pounds.
All right. So 4 pounds a gallon?
Yeah, plus the, and they're plastic buckets with metal handles. So they're like the big commercial paint buckets that you might get in the U.S.
So
I have one
like
for
that.
My students to practice fetching with that I bought it at a home improvement store. And it's what they sell to contractors for big paint cans.
This is back in Ohio.
Yeah, in Ohio, sorry.
Yeah, no.
And so it's just a metal handle. It might have a little plastic on it, a lid. And so if you just kind of around 20 pounds of water carrying it in your hands, it's very heavy. You do see people using 10-liter buckets now, which...
And two of them maybe to
Yeah,
balance.
So then generally you would probably carry two.
Yeah.
So you're distributing the weight. You'll see women carrying buckets on their head.
That's still largely a practice, right?
Yeah, you still see it quite often, carrying lots of things on their heads.
Right.
But it's a heavy bucket. My students in the U.S., I often have them fetch water.
Yeah.
And they say, and I tell them it's heavy, and they say that, oh, we're strong, we're
right.
tough, we can do it. And inevitably after 10 yards, they're putting the bucket down and rubbing their hands and saying that it's not very fun. Or they're covered in water because it splashes on them.
Yeah.
Or it bumps into their legs and the lid comes off. It's hard work.
Yeah.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
What about distance? I mean, the weight is one thing, but how long, and how long do some people have to carry these buckets?
In urban areas, the distance tends to be shorter, just because you have a higher density population.
Yeah.
So agencies like the United Nations, the World Health Organization, when they measure water access, so what does it take for someone to have access to water?
Because that's a complicated...
Yeah, it's a loaded kind of word.
Yeah, right.
Right now they're using 30 minutes for a round-trip walk, including the time to wait and fill the bucket. So if you imagine...
As having access.
So maybe a 10-minute walk, allow 10 minutes to fill and wait in a queue, and 10 minutes back. 10 minutes doesn't, even if we say 15 minutes because there's no wait, that doesn't sound like a long walk. But then when you're going back carrying 40 pounds of, or 20 pounds of water, maybe two buckets.
Yeah.
And Dar es Salaam is very hot, so potentially doing this in heat, it starts adding up.
Yeah.
And to think about how many trips you would have to make in one day, that 50 liters of water is considered the water poverty line, that a person should have at least 50 liters a day to not live in water poverty. Some people say 20 liters, 50 liters is a lot more realistic, to include clothes washing, bathing, cooking, cleaning,
for
drinking.
How many people?
For one person.
For one person, 50 liters a day, yeah.
So that would mean if you use that number, you would have to make 2.5 trips just for yourself. And most people here don't consume anywhere near that.
No.
So even if we just say 20 liters per person.
Which is the one trip.
One trip, but you don't meet a lot of single person households. I've met households with 20 people in them. So you think about how many trips are they doing. So even if it's not a long walk, cumulatively, it starts adding up. But the definitions just talk about singular trips. So 30 minutes for one trip, whether you're making one trip or 20 trips in a day. So it starts getting a lot more complicated in thinking about how many times are you fetching each day to understand the distance. And then it gets layers more complicated. A 15-minute walk on a flat, smooth road might be kind of nice, but you don't get a lot of flat, smooth roads here. You don't, as you start moving away from the more central areas, you don't have paved roads in hardly any places. So you're walking on uneven ground, often sand, which is where you're not getting steady footing.
Yeah.
If you have to go up or down elevation, you're maybe going through alleys, crossing busy roads. It starts to get a lot more complicated than just saying, oh, it's a 5-minute walk. But a 5-minute walk down a steep, crumbling staircase is not a terribly fun 5-minute walk.
No.
And then other things you might be walking past. We've done some research looking to quantify the challenges you might face. So how many times do you walk past standing water or an open drain or trash or traffic in addition to the distance and time?
So this is part of your current
project? This is part of some of my past research.
Yeah.
To really map out what does it look like
to go get water for you.
Yeah, because you look at it on paper and say, oh, well, they're walking 5 minutes each way, that it's not very far, but then you start looking at it and seeing
how many main roads
you
have to cross.
You just crossed a main road.
Yeah.
and there's very clear sewage next to you. You're walking through, you might be walking in it.
Yeah.
You're walking past trash.
So it's more details to sort of further unpack what that means to get water in an East African city or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those things would be pretty applicable in any major developing world city in terms of the challenges of water fetching. Every city has a slightly different dynamic. Some might have fewer places, you have longer queues. Others, if they're more planned out, the walking paths might be better, but I can't imagine any place where water fetching
is easy.
Yeah.
So there must be times of the day when it is more popular. Here in a very warm country, I assume early in the day and then really late in the day.
Yeah. So I ask people about their queues, if they fetch water, what their queues are. And generally it's busiest in the morning. People want to go to get water for their bath in the morning, to make tea, to get ready for work or for school. And then again in the evening when you're getting ready for dinner and for your evening activities. So if you have the luxury of being able to fetch during the day, it's a lot easier. You have fewer people to wait with. But most people are fetching early because then they go to work, or they have other responsibilities, so they're not just sitting around waiting for the lines to die down to fetch later. The one thing I have seen from the first time I looked at water in 2011 until now is that there is less fetching, and this is a positive thing. I don't always get to have positive research results that talking about fetching and these difficult walks is hard sometimes. But now we are seeing less fetching. People definitely still fetch. But the number of people with connections at their house has actually improved.
So inside each house compound or plot?
So a piped connection in Tanzania doesn't mean the same as it might mean in the United States or Europe, where to me a piped connection means I turn the faucet in my sink in my bathroom and I have water. I have it in my kitchen, my shower, my toilet. Here, it's just a direct pipe to the house. It could be interior or it could be exterior within the compound.
So it's kind of like having this spigot that we're calling it.
Yeah.
But right on your property. So you
don't,
so it eliminates the walk.
Yeah, so you might have to walk into your yard.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't, most people don't have pipes into their house. That their piped connection will be in their courtyard. And so they go from the bathroom to fetch water there, to get to fill their bucket there, or to fill their cup. So they're not fetching long distances, but it's not as simple as just turning the tap in the kitchen and having water. So there's no distinction between piped water everywhere in your house to one single tap in your yard. It counts the same in terms of this kind of work. But we're seeing less of that the city is putting an effort in improving its water. And so there are more connections now, which is benefiting people in two ways. Some are getting their own connections, but even those who can't afford their connection, that means maybe their neighbor now has a connection.
Yeah.
So they can fetch water a little closer to home.
So it's less than the line is shorter, the queue is shorter at the previous fetching points.
Yeah, so there's more of them. So they have, there's a line there, I can go to this person's house. That they have choice.
Yeah.
And it's often a lot closer. Or they might have it at their own house. That's also caused prices to drop because now there's some competition. So, so the prices are a little lower than they used to be. Not significantly, but just more water supply has eliminated the really drastic price hikes when there was a water shortage.
Yeah.
That When I first started doing the work, a 20-liter bucket was 50 shillings. Now it tends to go for more like 100 shillings. But it's about the same in terms of U.S. dollars because of the exchange rate.
Yeah.
100 shillings would be...
Yeah, it's like...
5 cents?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, roughly, roughly.
Yeah. And, but right, when right, I first started right. doing the work... Today, the exchange rate's 22.40. When I first came, it was 10.80. I still remember my first time exchanging money. So the exchange
it's
rate
kind of
is...
doubled. Yeah.
So the to us, if we convert it, the price is kind of the same for water. But
yeah.
unfortunately, salaries have not risen as other things have risen here.
Right. How do you pay for it at one of these points?
So a lot of... There's fewer of these kind of public points. They used to be government-run often. Now it's people, neighbors selling water. And so you just give coins to your neighbor. And you just... So it's a little bit of an honor system. They're not always standing there watching.
Yeah.
But they know when someone's right. filling water. So yeah, you just pay per bucket.
Huh.
So water's closer, which is definitely nice.
So we come to the end of another radio expedition, our 39th, our fourth season, coming to you now from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. We want to thank Dr. Sarah Smiley for sharing her experiences as a geographer working in the city of Dar es Salaam, Dar City Geographies. We also want to give a thanks to Kaidi Washington for use of his song, the theme song, to this season's episodes. The song itself we found on SoundCloud. It's called The Art of Escapism. Check out Cardi's work. Thanks again to everyone. We'll see you next month with another episode, our 40th, of Geographical Imaginations. Ciao.